Cohen, welcome back to Radio Times. Yesterday at the White House, President Obama called for calm in Ferguson, Missouri, after more than a week of protests following the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown, who's African-American and unarmed by a white police officer.
We have all seen images of protesters and law enforcement in the streets. It's clear that the vast majority of people are peacefully protesting. What's also clear is that a small minority of individuals are not. While I understand the passions and the anger that arise over the death of Michael Brown, giving into that anger by looting or carrying guns and even attacking the police only serves to raise tensions and stir chaos. It undermines rather than advancing justice.
Obama is sending Attorney General Eric Holder to Ferguson tomorrow to assess the situation. Local law enforcement has been criticized for its militaristic approach to the demonstrators and lack of transparency. Missouri Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson was called in to deal with the public anger and frustration. He has talked with protesters, spoke movingly at a ceremony for Michael Brown, and had tough words early this morning about criminals he says have come to Ferguson to cause trouble.
But anyone who has been at these protests understands that there is a dangerous dynamic in the night. It allows a small number of violent agitators to hide in the crowd and then attempt to create chaos. The catalyst can be bottles thrown, Molotov cocktails, and of course shots fired. Protesters are peaceful and respectful. Protesters don't clash with police. They don't throw Molotov cocktails. It is criminals who throw Molotov cocktails and fire shots and endanger lives and property.
There were 31 arrests last night. Reports of two men who were shot as law enforcement used tear gas and flash grenades to disperse the crowd. The National Guard was called in by the governor. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Jerry Ratcliffe. He's a professor of criminal justice at Temple University, also director of the University's Center for Security and Crime Science. Jerry Ratcliffe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be back, Martin.
Also with us is Chief Bill Kelly, and he's chief of police at Abington Township. He's also president of the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association. And Chief Kelly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's my pleasure.
Jerry, let me begin with you. And I have to say, looking at what happened last night and even what's happening today, it feels as if things are falling apart in Ferguson, Missouri. How do you see it?
Oh, it certainly looks terrible. The optics are not good in the slightest. I think you have two separate sort of questions here. How do we get here from the long-term perspective? And you can think about issues such as social inequality, racial disparities. And it seems to be a lack of a police and community relationship in the long term. And then you have a short-term incident that sparked how the police have responded in the short term. And I think people are seeing for the first time the results of a trend that's actually been growing for decades. And it's to do with a number of related issues about police equipment and tactics. What sorts of equipment do police departments need to do their job, and what do police chiefs need to get for their officers to keep them safe? But I think there are also questions about how and when should these different types of equipment be used. And so those are different questions that are coming out there, especially an issue in the short term and with all the optics and everything that people are seeing on the television.
But do you think that the police, in a sense, got off on the wrong foot when early on there they were in camo with assault weapons, looking like with military equipment there, that sent the original wrong message to the people of Ferguson?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think there are many people in policing who have spent time looking at public order policing and thinking about how to police demonstrations that would disagree with that. There is certainly, once you start ramping things up, once you're at a heightened level, there's nowhere to go. Whereas if the police had started with a little bit more of a conciliatory tone and tried to see a little bit more of the perspective of the people who were demonstrating legally and lawfully, then they would have had a capacity to go to a more aggressive stance had things got worse. But they started out in that position, then they've given themselves nowhere to go.
How do you see what's going on in Ferguson, Chief Kelly?
Well, I agree with some of those things, but this verbiage about military wear and so on, a lot of these things have been used by police forces for years and years. This is not a new thing. It's not something all of a sudden we're getting from the military. The camouflage is something that has replaced the primarily black outfits that the SWAT teams used in the past, and they use those black outfits often at nighttime and the camouflage during the daytime, not because they want to look like the military, but because the SWAT teams are the ones that go into those situations where there is likely to be gunplay. So it is just a common and practical thing to do. Now, I'm not saying that that should be used in all situations by any means, and certainly, as Jerry said, maybe if they hadn't done that right away at the beginning when they're trying to do crowd control, that might have been part of the problem.
Well, let me just pick up on that. I mean, the idea of using people in camo with these large assault rifles dealing with demonstrators, doesn't that send a kind of militaristic message to demonstrators?
Yeah, it certainly might. And obviously, there's been mistakes made. There's no question about that.
You know, is it a kind of psychology, and this is to you, Jerry Ratcliffe, is there a kind of psychology that goes along with, you know, being in camo and having all this military weaponry that, I mean, soldiering is different from policing. But when you're wearing the garb and you're using the weapons, do people end up thinking like they're in the military dealing with an enemy?
I think when you start to say how are people thinking when they're wearing that equipment, if there's 800,000 police officers in the United States, it's hard to categorize them all with a sort of sweeping brush in that regard. I think there's actually, to some degree, a psychology on both sides. When police officers turn up in their new normal uniforms to a crowd or a demonstration, it depends on the nature of that demonstration. I think a lot of the times demonstrations themselves are a little bit unfocused and people in the crowd are not necessarily, especially when they're spontaneous, not necessarily sure what to do. So if police officers turn up in regular gear, then that sends a signal that, okay, we might just keep marching and demonstrating. Mm-hmm. If police officers turn up in a riot gear, that sends a signal to the crowd, who are often a bit unfocused, who are thinking, okay, so we must be in a riot. And you can see that with the different responses of police departments around the country to the Occupy movement, as an example. So what you have is a situation where it got a little bit ramped up too quickly in places like Oakland, California. But here in Philadelphia, we have a more experienced and I think a more mature leadership team. So what you have in California, the police brought riot shields and tear gas, and in Philadelphia, the police brought coffee.
Huh. And you think that made the difference?
Absolutely.
What we also hear, Chief Kelly, from Captain Ron Johnson, which is that he's dealing with several things. One is peaceful protesters who are protesting the death of this young man and what he describes as perhaps opportunistic criminals who are using some of the chaos as a way to cause trouble. That, I would think, causes even greater challenges to a police force. They're trying to both keep the peace and protect people, but also allow people to demonstrate.
Well, not only that, what about the people that have come in from out of town to sort of rile everything up? I mean, certainly they have to take some responsibility for what's going on as well. I find it fascinating that we're focusing on what the police did to cause the thing to escalate, when in fact, if you really look at it, there's a lot of other factors that cause this thing to escalate beyond that, to the point that I think that regardless what the police were wearing, there was going to be a certain reaction, and that was going to continue to escalate because people were being riled up. Obviously, when Reverend Sharpton and so on coming in like that, certainly why is he not in this conversation? Why is he not part of the – obviously, he has as much to do, if not more, than the police that originally responded to that.
Because of the words that he said? I mean, you're talking about, what, outside agitators coming in and riling up the crowds?
Well, of course.
But it's something – did he say something, you think, that got the crowd more angry and upset than they were before?
Well – He obviously, by his very verbiage, by the things he's said, by the way he's done it, he deliberately tries to, and he's very good at that. He's very good at motivating people and mobilizing people, and that's fine. I'm not hearing him coming out and saying we need to stop the violence. I'm not hearing him say that. Now, he may be doing that, but I haven't heard that. I've heard him talk about we need to get justice and we need to do all of these other things and we need to force this and we need to do all those things and get people really mobilized. But there obviously is a responsibility at some point to turn around and say, okay, now some mm-hmm. of you have gone too far and we need to tamp this down. And this point is now, once the police have gotten there and done all those things, they're just trying to clean up the mess that's going on there right now. What about the responsibility of the people who in the community? What about the leaders? What about the people who have come in from out of town and that continue to rile this thing up? And it's interesting because we keep talking about, well, what did the police do that's causing mm-hmm. this? And I think that they had a role, certainly, and we have to do our job and do it well. But I think we're almost skirting the issue.
Well, but it is the job of police departments to, as we all know, serve and protect, or protect and serve. I mean, it is their job to try to keep the peace. Yes,
it is their job, but in certain situations, it is virtually a situation that is impossible. When it gets so bad and you send the police officers into that situation, they have one or two choices. They either allow the rioting and all of those things to go on unchecked, and the looting and the burning and so on, or they have to immerse themselves into it to try to stop people from doing it. As soon as you do that, it's dangerous for the officers, it's dangerous for the citizens, and then they get criticized for using force at that particular point, when the fact of the matter is, cooler heads and talking should be making this thing quiet down for a while, just because what's happening is wrong.
Let me give you a chance, Jerry, to respond to that.
Bill's absolutely right. After a while, you reach the situation. I feel some sympathy for the police officers who've been asked to come and police this when it's already clearly got out of hand. And so you're stuck with a situation which is that things aren't going to change, and they haven't changed in the last few nights in terms of, to some degree, the police equipment and how they use it. Because police officers in the United States, especially senior police chiefs, have a legal obligation to look out for the occupational health and safety of their officers. And so that raises questions about what is the appropriate equipment for them to be using in this situation. You showed the clip from Johnson, who talked about a dangerous dynamic, and from President Obama, talked about people carrying guns and attacking the police. So unfortunately, we've reached the situation now where the National Guard have been called in, and I think there just has to be a resolution of order, and at some point later on, other issues of justice will come to the fore. But at the moment, some degree of security and order is going to have to be resolved first before other issues can now be addressed.
One of the things I was reading, and I don't know Ferguson, Missouri, so I can't speak with any authority, but one of the things I was reading about is that there haven't been relationships developed between the police, the local police there, and community leaders. And I mean, that seems to me, and Jerry, about 30 seconds before our break here, but that seems to me critical to have community leaders that can dialogue with members of law enforcement.
It does become tricky when you don't have the sorts of relations that we would hope to have in other places. I think you end up with the situation that you're going to have to simply restore order where you don't have it. Fortunately, good police officers still engaging in community policing, even though there's been a bit of a rush towards homeland security and those types of, people want equipment more than training. They want hard tactics rather than soft skills. So there has been a bit of a loss of that since 9/11, but this has shown the vital importance of community policing still within the United States.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jerry Ratcliffe. He's a professor of criminal justice at Temple University, director of the university's Center for Security and Crime Science. Bill Kelly, chief of police at Abington Township, which I should say is just outside of Philadelphia. He's also president of the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Holman Cadillac proudly supports WHYY. During Holman Cadillac Summer's Best event, over 200 of the season's collection of new and pre-owned Cadillacs are available for a test drive. More at Holman Cadillac on Route 73 in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and online at holmancadillac.com.
In Studio 360, we strive for balance.
We're trying to capture something that's real, but at the same time, we're trying to capture something that can be used to underline certain themes or ideas.
Like filmmaker Errol Morris, we can be a little opinionated. Every week, we bring you outspoken stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and big ideas. Get inside the creative mind.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The Wright brothers changed the world with their first flight, but perhaps they also changed our national psyche.
Wow. If flesh and blood human beings like me can do that, what can't we do?
The history of aviation next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO, smart ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking about the crisis in Ferguson, Missouri. And again, Jerry Ratcliffe and Chief Bill Kelly with us here in our Philadelphia studio. Joining us now by telephone is Chief Joe Sullivan, and he's Chief of Homeland Security for the Philadelphia Police Department. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to have to be invited to participate. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us as well. What do you see as the appropriate use of a SWAT team?
We see the appropriate use of a SWAT team is whenever we have to counter a ballistic threat, a life-endangering threat to the public or to our officers. And when officers, normal patrol officers, run into a situation that is beyond their capability, that they are trained to then call for SWAT, and for very good reasons. Statistics show that even in a very volatile situation, if it can be contained and then turned over to a well-trained SWAT team working in conjunction with trained negotiators, the likelihood of that being resolved peacefully increases exponentially. And well, I think in Philadelphia, we have the statistics to prove that.
And I guess we're talking about things like hostage situations or what, high risk?
Hostage situations, suicidal persons, emotionally disturbed persons, domestics that turn into barricaded situations. We've handled 188 of those in the last 5 years here in Philadelphia, and we've done so without having to use deadly force. And that's because our SWAT operators know that the purpose of SWAT is to save lives. That is why SWAT exists. That is our standard. That is our mission statement. That's our operational tempo. That's what we're there for. We're there to contain a situation. And again, SWAT works very closely with the hostage negotiators. The majority of my SWAT operators have actually gone through hostage negotiation training, because sometimes they're the initial person that make contact with someone in crisis. And also, by going through that training, they understand what it is that the negotiators are trying to accomplish and how to support that effort.
I know you don't want to talk directly about Ferguson, Missouri, but I'm going to ask it as a kind of generic question. Are there times you think that you need a SWAT team when there are street protests?
When there are what?
Street protests.
Certainly, that is not something that you will see in Philadelphia. I also command the Civil Affairs Unit, who is responsible for policing protests in Philadelphia. And certainly, we do not deploy SWAT with the Civil Affairs Unit. We have the Civil Affairs Unit. They're a very unique unit. They are plainclothes officers. They are the first line of contact between police and protesters because they represent a less threatening appearance, a less official or militarized appearance, because the best way to handle a disturbance is a protest, a demonstration, whether it be labor, regardless of the reason, is number one, to try to communicate with the people holding the protest in advance and try to find out what are their objectives, what are they hoping to accomplish through the protest, and see how we can facilitate that and make sure that they understand that we don't see the idea of a demonstration or a protest is a negative thing. We see it as a very positive application of the First Amendment, and we believe that it's our job to support and facilitate that, not in any way to hamper it or to impede it in any way. That's just an improper use of the police.
Well, hold on one second. I want to get our two guests here in on the conversation. Jerry, anything you want to say in response to what Joe Sullivan was just talking about?
Well, I mean, I think Joe's demonstrating how more experienced departments take a have the opportunity to use the right resources for the right tool, and clearly that's coming through in Philadelphia. The challenge becomes a little bit with smaller police departments.
Yes.
And Joe and Bill come from very two different spectrums.
Yes.
With smaller police departments, you have fewer access to resources. You can't afford to, in small departments, to maintain a civil affairs department. But what's also happening over, and it's good to hear that there haven't been any SWAT-related deaths in the last 5 years, but what you also find is the nature of the threat has changed. I mean, if we've come back 20 years ago, we would never have heard about things such as school shooters or mall shooters or rampage shooters or the sovereign citizen movement. So even though crime has come down pretty much every year, violent crime has come down in the U.S. over the last 20 years, the nature of that threat to police officers has changed and has become much more specific and requires a different type of training and approach in certain circumstances.
You're saying people are targeting police more?
Oh, we hear about police officers being ambushed. And who'd have, you know, we started to hear about this thing, suicide by cop, you know, where people will actively go and provoke police officers so that they will be killed by her colleagues. And what you end up with, his or her colleagues, and what you end up with is these things that we'd never heard of before. And we don't hear of suicide by radio show host or suicide by college professor.
No.
So it's a very specific nature of the job that relates to policing in the 21st century in America.
Chief Kelly, let me give you a chance to weigh in as well.
I agree with what Jerry is saying. Philadelphia Police Department is an outstanding police department, a professional police department. It's also a very large police department, so they have the ability and resources to do some of these things with different individuals. In the smaller police departments, the specially trained individuals may have to do double duty of being on the SWAT team and also on the crowd control group. And they may have the only outfit that they have that has the equipment and the tear gas masks and so on and so forth is the same one. And so sometimes that's an issue, and that creates a more difficult dynamic in that situation. But obviously, Philadelphia deserves a lot of credit for the outstanding job that they do and the great way they approach it.
Joe Sullivan, one thing I was reading in preparation for the show is about the increased use of SWAT teams. I don't know whether you can speak to that or not. I know that you work here in Philadelphia, but that more and more police departments are relying on SWAT teams to do what police departments used to do normally in the past. Can you respond to that?
Now, what you're referring to, because, I mean, we definitely express to our patrol officers that when they feel that they have encountered a resistant suspect, especially one that's armed or a potentially suicidal one, we certainly encourage them to utilize SWAT. Again, because we know that the mere presence of SWAT often gains compliance. We also know that SWAT officers are very highly trained. My officers go through hundreds of hours of mandatory training every year. And because they are better equipped in terms of their ballistic protection, in terms of their training, and even in terms of their firearms, and in terms of their less lethals, they have a wide range of less lethal options that we can employ. Mm-hmm. And we also have a lot of tools in our toolbox. We have cameras and we have robots, and they prevent confrontations. If we believe that someone is armed inside a home, and rather than go in there, we can insert a robot. And I have a variety of robots that I can literally clear a house in the 95% to 99% without sending someone in there. And if I find someone in there, then the decision is to continue negotiations and remain outside. If the robot shows me that the property is empty, then we can safely go in and clear it and get that neighborhood back to normal. But it prevents confrontation. So in that regard, yes, we encourage officers to in that vein, but not in terms of protest and demonstrators. They are, protesters are not suspects. Protesters are citizens expressing their rights, gathering in public places to do what makes this country great, and that is to debate, dissent, and to generate discussion. So, SWAT does not play a role in that.
I hear you. Hold on, only because Chief Kelly wants to say something. Then we're going to have to say goodbye to you.
Talking about the SWAT team being used more often, ACLU has made that sound like that's a terrible thing. That's just like saying, what about doctors using specialists more often? it makes sense, doesn't it? And you see that happening in medicine, that the doctors are using the specialists more often because they've got the expertise, the training, and the equipment to do the job. So using SWAT and police work is the exact same thing.
We have to say goodbye to you, Chief Joe Sullivan. Thanks for joining us in this hour of Radio Times.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Chief of Home, you too as well. And Chief of Homeland Security for the Philadelphia Police Department, staying with us for the rest of the hour, Chief Bill Kelly. He's Chief of Police at Abington Township, just outside of Philadelphia. Again, President of the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association. Jerry Ratcliffe with us as well, Professor of Criminal Justice at Temple University, where he's Director of the University's Center for Security and Crime Science. We have a explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Just one quick thing I want to toss to you, though, Jerry, and one of the criticisms of the militarization of the police is that the police have not gotten the kind of training that it sounds like Joe Sullivan says that SWAT officers have. True, not true?
Well, we generally have poorer standards of training across the board in the United States than we do in other countries.
For police officers generally?
Yes. And so a lot of it's to some degree our own fault. We demand services here in the United States, but we really don't want to pay for them. And as a result, what we find is when we look at comparisons of the lengths of training, the types of training between different places, what you find is that the U.S. generally lags behind a little bit. So it's very difficult. You have, I think one of the areas where there's a challenge in terms of training is that you have police departments who are cash-strapped, and so the first thing that goes is the training budget. And the second thing that goes is sometimes the capacity to buy the right sort of equipment that they need for the job. Because some of these armored personnel carriers run to hundreds of thousands of dollars that police departments simply can't afford. And so along comes the Department of Defense and says you can have this stuff for free.
This is the 1033 program.
Exactly. Right? And you can have this stuff for free, and it may not be exactly suitable for purpose, but it's better than nothing. And if you have an obligation to protect the health and safety and the welfare of your officers, why wouldn't you take something that's for free? Mm. The challenge then becomes, if you have a piece of equipment, it's very tempting to use it, but do you necessarily have the training that's available in public order situations? It's great to know how to use something. It's much more important to know when to use it. And generally across the United States, that level of training in terms of large demonstrations, public and public disturbances or public order events isn't available, and really isn't available as required to small-town police departments.
Do you want to speak to that? And then we'll get to our callers and emailers and tweeters.
And what happens is we train the police for the things they're most likely to encounter in big cities like Philadelphia. You know there's going to be protests. In small towns, it almost never happens. So as a result, the amount of training in those areas are less. Of course it is, because there's only so much training money to go around.
Let me get to it. Looks like Lisa from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I just want to say how offensive Chief Kelly's comments about Al Sharpton are. Al Sharpton did not incite violence in Ferguson. What Al Sharpton did was call for transparency for what happened to Michael Brown. And for you to have Chief Kelly there on air identifying Sharpton being an outsider, when a small community like Ferguson would never have gotten the attention that it has now internationally without Al Sharpton's presence and commentary on what's happening. He did not incite violence. I also think it's offensive that you don't have any people of color on your panel today to add to this discussion. Because what we're talking about is how, in Ferguson, is how communities of color are by the police department.
Well, no, that's first of all, Lisa, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and we're happy to have Chief Bill Kelly on as well as others. I'm sure we'll be following up on this as well. And to be perfectly honest with you, we were interested in talking to people whose job it is to provide police protection and to get their perspective on it. But let me give you a chance, Chief Kelly, to respond to Lisa's criticism of Al Sharpton, because, I mean, in many ways, yes, he's an activist. These are issues that he cares about. He often goes to places where there is a crisis or there is trouble, but he is certainly not recently has said anything that would rile up an audience to go and attack the police.
And let me just say this. I wasn't trying to criticize Mr. Sharpton, Reverend Sharpton, or anyone else. My point is that there's a lot of factors going on into this issue, and to just focus on, well, this is all happening because the uniforms that the police wore early on in the demonstrations, I think is to miss the complexity of this type of a situation, the dynamics of this type of situation.
There is this issue, though, of transparency, and I want to put this to you, Jerry, and Lisa mentioned this, and I think in many ways what residents are calling for is more information about the police officer, more information about what happened, and the sense that either information is being withheld or given out in increments that seems to exacerbate the situation. One is the picture of Michael Brown at a convenience store where it looks like he's taking something. There's some questions about whether he had marijuana in his system. All of that seems to inflame people in terms of the police offering people information that they can know that something is going on.
And this comes back to something that Bill said a bit earlier. Clearly, there's a small town police department and a relatively small county police department that are completely swamped and having to deal with situations and circumstances that they've never had to encounter before. So they're essentially making it up as they go, and I think they're trying to do the best they can. They, you know, started by releasing a little bit of information, got criticized for that, released more, got criticized for that. I think they're in a situation where there's not a lot they can do that's right at this point. And the tricky part with it is they're simply unprepared for dealing with this level of this sort of situation. The other tricky part is that we've seen the information that's come out has changed. And so what police chiefs want to do is take a step back and do a proper and thorough investigation and find out what's going on, which doesn't go so well with the community and the media who want instant answers in our 24/7 world. And that's a little bit unprofessional when you don't really know what's going on to try and use piecemeal information when you really want to get a complete picture. So I think the police want to get a complete picture, but they're being pressurized to rush to release information that we're finding out sometimes isn't accurate.
I mean, Lisa criticized me for having a bunch of white people on the show talking about this issue, but to you, both of you, how much do you think the fact that we're talking about a largely African-American community, Ferguson, Missouri, and a largely white police force, I'll put that to you, Chief Bill Kelly.
Well, of course that's the issue. Of course that's a problem. And there's reasons for those things in many cases. As an example, the population changed in Ferguson in a relatively short period of time. The people on police departments are on there usually for 20, 25 years at a time before they retire. So sometimes those are dynamics that just occur. But there has to be increased sensitivity. There has to be increased work to make that happen. And the issue that Jerry was talking about the need for departments to develop those relationships and have the community policing and to incorporate the community in the decision making is absolutely critical, and if that wasn't there, I don't know if it wasn't, but if that wasn't there, then that certainly was part of the problem.
Jerry, you want to speak to that?
Oh, come to a question about race from somebody with my accent who's clearly not from Philadelphia.
No.
These things, race seems to permeate absolutely everything in Philadelphia, in the United States. It is a factor in so much of what we do, and it's a factor in policing. So Bill's absolutely right. The tricky part is you're not going to rebuild those relationships within the time frame that's necessary to resolve this incident. But I think there's definitely a lesson here for police chiefs and other places to rethink and look at the relations they have with minority communities, wherever they are, irrespective of the makeup of their police department. I'm not entirely sure that's necessarily a factor in it. The research isn't particularly clear on that, but it's clearly necessary that having relationships, whatever is the makeup of your police department, obviously having officers of color does make a difference.
Alicia, I do appreciate that call to Radio Times. You can call us as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chapin School, a pre-K through 8th grade independent school in Princeton, supports WHYY. With small classes and high academic expectations, Chapin students receive personal attention from a faculty dedicated to helping them succeed academically. Chapin's focus on the virtues of respect, responsibility, honesty, kindness, and perseverance seeks to nurture students with a strong moral fiber. Chapin students also demonstrate strong abilities in the arts, music, sports, and technology. More at chapinschool.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the disillusionment of an American physician in this era when doctors are pressured to spend less time with patients and more time doing paperwork, while in many cases their income is decreasing. We talk with Dr. Sandeep Johar, author of the new book, Doctored. He directs the heart failure program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The beginning of the school year in Ferguson, Missouri has brought historic tension and violence.
I wanted to go to school today, but they canceled it because of the riots. I think they should stop the riots because it's messing up the kids' education.
What will students learn about the role of government and police in keeping the peace when classes finally start? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking about what many people are talking about, the crisis in Ferguson, Missouri. And again, our guests are Jerry Ratcliffe and Bill Kelly. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me just go back to this, the what is described as the militarization of police. And if there is a psychology or a mentality that goes along with that, the people that you are dealing with then become the enemy, not residents in a community. And I guess I'm back to some degree on the psychology, but the truth is the Defense Department, as a result of the war on drugs and also September 11th and the terrorist attacks, have been selling or giving millions or perhaps even billions of dollars worth of leftover equipment to some of these communities.
Well, they have been, and you have to understand the situation. We don't have to do anything, but it's appreciable to understand the situation of a small town police chief or a small town who feel an onus of responsibility, and they have a legal obligation to provide protection for the people that do a job that continues to change and is dynamic, and as I said before, the nature of the threats change. So when they're short of money, and when they don't have the money for it, it's a choice of, do I buy a vehicle that provides protection for my officers, or do I spend more money on training for my special victims unit who can better deal with rape victims? You have to make tough choices.
Right.
So one of them is a little bit easier, as if somebody comes along and said, one of those things I can give you for free. And it allows police departments to free up limited resources for other things that they see as equally important. The tricky part is whether that equipment is fit for purpose. And in many cases, it's obviously overkill. These MRAPs, these mine-resistant armored vehicles, are clearly not necessary for the streets of 99.9% of the United States, maybe all of them. But if that's the only option that you have, and these things cost $750,000,
right.
So you're left with a situation where there is available a vehicle, vehicles and equipment. There is some incentive on police departments to use it. And I think what will come from this is police departments will think a lot about their community policing and their community relations. But when the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, meet in Orlando in October, I'll bet there'll be quite a few police chiefs thinking, we are wholly unprepared if something like Ferguson happens in our community, and they'll be worried.
Well, let me pick up on this community policing thing. I've lost track of the numbers of programs we've done on this show about community policing. Everyone seems to talk about it, and yet when you look at Ferguson, and I'm looking at you, Bill Kelly, you see the breakdown of community policing. And why is it so? I guess why is it so hard to institute community policing?
Well, it's fine to use the terminology. Of course, everybody talks about it because it sounds so cool. But the actual implementation of it and developing partnerships and all of that is very difficult in some respects and very critical. Our department was just recognized by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, one of only three in the world to receive their Community Policing Award this last year. We're very proud of that. But it took a lot of work by the community and the department. We spend a lot of time and a lot of effort on that because we value that and it's important. And one thing I want to say about the equipment, the military equipment, the important thing is the training. It used to be that police SWAT teams were trained by military teams. We don't do that at all anymore. Hardly any SWAT teams do that anymore because their mission is totally different. We use
it's not military, right?
Exactly. We do police SWAT team training, which approaches it in a totally different way. And so you can use the equipment, the same equipment, but understanding how it needs to be used in a different way.
Let me get Hugh from Westchester to join our conversation. Hi, Hugh. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, my question has to do with the that there's been no police report issued by the police department. Surely the small town aspect of this police department could issue that police report, and the fact that that would be public knowledge but the grand jury is going to be secret is probably fueling some of the anger in that town. And why has that not been issued? Because that would pin down the officer's story, and it looks now like they may try to tailor it. And that should have been issued, and it should be public knowledge, and that might have something to do with cooling things down.
Hugh, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Jerry, if I can toss that back to you, we talked about transparency, but this is, you know, wanting to share information with the public.
Yes, and I think the police department, firstly, I think at the moment they are completely swamped and overwhelmed and have their hands full. And so it's probably all hands on deck at this point, just trying to keep the city from stop completely burning to the ground. But Hugh's absolutely right. At this point, I think we're in the situation where we have exceptional circumstances, and it may need an exceptional change of what's normal policy to help resolve the situation.
No. Well, and the Attorney General is going there tomorrow. I don't know what he can or cannot do, but obviously some focus. Do you see this as important, this police report that released?
Obviously it is, and obviously we're hesitant to second guess any of our because we're not there, but not only are the citizens asking that question, candidly many of us in law enforcement are saying, why aren't they getting this information out there? It obviously is needed. Everyone has that curiosity about that, needs to have that information, and much of this probably could have been avoided had they been able to get more of that out there sooner. Obviously, Jerry's point about the needing to make sure it's correct, though, in when you've got all this variety of information is a challenge, but certainly that's fueling a lot of this.
Let me get Julian from Trooper to join us. Julian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. So I was sort of thinking about this. I find it sort of troubling, this odd little double standard that, on the one hand, a person who accidentally or with malice aforethought murders a police officer, say in the process of a robbery, may in a lot of jurisdictions in the United States be given the death penalty or sent to life in prison. The same standard does not tend to be applied to police officers who betray their oath to protect and serve and kill civilians. And I was wondering what the guests' thoughts were on this.
Well, I don't know whether it's a semantic difference between, you know, killing someone and murdering somebody, but have you thought about this, Jerry Ratcliffe?
There is a tendency for people to think, I think, as Julian does. We don't see a situation that everybody who commits murder and everybody who kills somebody else in the United States gets the death penalty. There is very little room nowadays. I think the change that's happened during my lifetime is there's very little room now for genuine and honest mistakes. But that does happen. Uh-huh. If you think about the number of interactions that police officers have with members of the community across the United States every single year, we know this from some of the stop and frisk numbers and some of the pedestrian investigative stops in Philadelphia. They run into the hundreds of thousands. So when you're approaching a car and the windows are all tinted out and it's late at night and you have no idea what you're approaching, when you have millions and millions of these things taking place across the United States every day or every year, then at some point mistakes will happen without a doubt. And I think people make mistakes. The general public make mistakes in robberies, but not everybody gets the death sentence.
Let me turn to you, Bill Kelly, and we have about 10 minutes or so before we have to say goodbye. So how do you see this situation not just getting diffused, but addressing some of the concerns that have been raised by the community, by some of the callers here on the show as well, which is people want to feel as if they've been heard. They want to feel as if there will be justice for the killing of this young man and that some sort of lessons will be learned going forward.
Well, one of the things that the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association are going to be doing in the upcoming weeks is talking to some of the other major organizations, including the District Attorney's Association, the Attorney General's Office, and so on. and the idea of developing some training and also some teams that would be able to be deployed when if a small department runs into a situation like this, they would be able to bring in the expertise that would help them do two things better. Number one, handle the situation with the media and all of those things like that. And secondly, to ensure that the investigation was being handled in a way that had total credibility. And we think that if by instituting those things, especially since in Pennsylvania, there's 1,200 police departments. Obviously, some of those are very small police departments. They don't have the resources. This might be a way to help get those resources to those departments.
What do you see as I mean, what do you hope for, I guess, moving forward?
Well, I think what the community would like in Ferguson is some sense of justice. I'm not sure they're clear on what that is and will necessarily be satisfied by some of the things that come out of it. But Bill's absolutely right. I mean, there are long-term lessons to pull from this situation. Police officers shoot people, the vast majority of times justified across the United States, about 400 times a year. About 400 people are killed every year by police officers. The vast majority of those times it's justified. The challenge is, what do we do in these circumstances where there is some dispute about that? Whether that's true or not, how do you deal with the situation initially? And I think that's an area that's clearly not had enough attention paid to it by police departments, and that's becoming evident in Ferguson.
Well, indeed, when there's so much suspicion of what the police's department is doing or saying or any of the tactics that we've been observing in the last 10
years. Oh, yes, and there are definitely the long-term issues that have to be addressed by how police departments and communities work together. There has to be a meeting from both sides there. But then there are the short-term operational decisions about how you deal with situations that could potentially get out of control. And there really isn't enough training on that. I looked at the web pages of the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and there's no shortage of training on SWAT team tactics and that kind of thing. There's lots of information and training on how to use some of the tools they have, and not enough information, in fact, pretty much none, about when to use it.
Oh, interesting. Let me get, looks like Carl from Somerville, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Carl, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. There.
Good morning.
I appreciate your show. I appreciate the gentleman, but this is not really a police problem. As horrific as the death of this young man and many other young men in this nation have lost their life, the real issue here is you got basically an old boy network going on. And it's not about small police department or big police department. You can look at Genesis, you can look at L.A., you can look at all these different places. When people don't respect and feel like they've been disfranchised for 40, 50 years, you know, and the police force, you know, you have a small-town police force, and you got that good old blue line that nobody is going to go through, and you got this built-up old boy tradition, you're going to have this, whether it be in big city or little city, whether you have a SWAT team or no SWAT team. I mean, those things are good, but you're missing the point. These are only the symptoms. If we don't start dealing with these situations, all right, and rectifying things socially, politically, and culturally, you can make all the laws you want to. We're going to head for a military police state. And you know what? As the saying goes, they came for you first, and then they're going to keep on going for each other.
Well, Carl, I appreciate the call to Radio Times and Bill Kelly. I mean, he's talking about, you know, old wounds, old hurts, the history of racism in this country.
Absolutely. And it's the challenge that we have going forward to continue to work on that. He's absolutely right in the sense that that's the hurdle that policing has to get over. And we have to do more in that direction. But I got to tell you, I see the movement going the opposite the way he is. I see that more and more police departments understand the importance of the transparency, of getting rid of that good old boy appearance and so on, and immersing itself with the community. And if that happens, then these are going to happen less and less.
Do you think Obama can and should say something to sort of addressing what Carl was just saying?
Oh, I mean, Carl raises a fascinating issue, and Carl's absolutely right. There are these long-term generational problems. that are very difficult for police officers to address and change. I think there's a generational change happening in policing. More than half the police officers who are serving today in the United States were not police officers when 9/11 happened.
Oh, really?
So we have a new generation of police officers coming through. And I think it provides an opportunity, but you definitely have a generational issue within policing that's seeing the sorts of changes. And I would like to be optimistic for the future and for Carl, but... who knows?
Yeah, Carl, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I should have said this early on in the show, but Jerry, you were a police officer in Britain.
Yes, until I managed to throw myself down a mountain ice climbing.
Oh, is that right?
I was a police officer for 11 years in the Metropolitan Police and worked Central London. So I've been in a number of the demonstrations. For people who know the UK, I was at Wapping, which was a large print workers dispute that ran on for a couple of years and was quite violent at times. Broadwater Farm, which had racial tensions in Tottenham in the north of London. And so I've been in situations where things have been very tense, and how they were dealt with and how those situations were dealt with there is a little bit different than how they've been handled in Ferguson. I'm seeing some things that I would have hoped that we'd learn the mistakes from, but we don't necessarily see that. But it's hard to learn the lessons from places, and hopefully there's an opportunity here for police departments to figure out what they would do better next time.
I want to see if I can squeeze one more caller. We may run out of time, but Dan, very quickly, joining us on Radio Times, Dan from Reading, go ahead.
Hi, yes. Thank you so much. I just wanted to comment, we live in a democracy, and it seems like it's a lack of communication. Why not, or a lack of policy, planning, strategy, management by the police, creating an us-against-them mentality? And why not gear these demonstrations to town meetings? And why aren't the mayors and the politicians getting involved to try to diffuse and de-escalate the situation rather than continuing to militarize the situation by creating a police force that looks like the military? And it's very concerning, because you can look internationally.
All right. Well, Dan I knew we were going to run out of time. Let me give our guest, Bill Kelly, a chance to respond to that. People are stuck on this notion of the militarization of the police, and I think in part because that's what it looks like.
Well, I think it's being portrayed a lot by the media, and I don't think it's happening as much as it's being portrayed. But let me just say this. When I was growing up, one of my heroes was Martin Luther King. And I think in this situation, Dr. King would certainly demand accountability and transparency and change and all of those things. On the other hand, I know that he also would decry the violence. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of that has to be worked in here. We can have change, we can have accountability and transparency without having this ongoing violence, which is kind of distracting us.
Well, and I think it should also be said that most of the people that are demonstrating peacefully, and some have intervened to prevent some of the violence as well. Chief Bill Kelly, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. And Jerry Ratcliffe, thank you for joining us as well.
Pleasure.
And go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us.